This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's a misty, monochrome kind of day. There is a sailing yacht out there, but it's moving incredibly slowly. Behind me, I've got the old Victorian rail bridge. Then we've got the 1960s road bridge. And behind that, the brand new third crossing across the Forth.
We did the north side of the River Forth, traced its origins, its history, and we ended up on the new bridge, which we helped build, by the way.
Of course, later.
This week, we thought we'd look at the south side. So I'm quite excited because the last time we found all kinds of things we knew nothing about. Hopefully this will be the same.
Where we're standing at the moment was the site of the original, I mean, it's Queen's Ferry. It's where the ferry carried pilgrims from St Andrews all the way down south. But we're starting right at the far end of the River Forth in Stirling Castle. It's absolutely steering here in the forecourt of Stirling Castle. Joe Bennett's one of the guides. Where are we in the castle just now?
Well, this is the entrance to the castle today. It's a mixture of both 18th and 19th century. We're coming under just now the Queen Anne Archway, which is part of the 18th century outer defences built between the years of 1708 and 1714.
The gatehouse immediately in front of us is very businesslike. I mean, it's got the arrow slits and things. You can make somebody's life difficult here if you were on the right side of the wall. But the decorative work across there is fantastic. There are pillars with statuary on top of it. It wasn't just a fortress.
No, that's absolutely correct. It was both a fortress, but then a royal residence, primarily from the days of the Stuart dynasty itself.
And although Ewan says this place kind of oozes, don't even try it, lots of people did. This was under siege heaps of times.
Very much so. It was changing hands on an almost continual basis in the early wars of independence from 1296 to 1304.
This is us going through yet another archway, and in front of us, probably the most distinctive building in the whole complex.
The Great Hall, again of King James IV's reign, with its distinctive colour of king's gold.
Well, so that's not recent then?
It is. Back in the 1990s, the decision was made to put the colour back on to reflect what would have been the original colour of the Great Hall and indeed much of the castle. We've come into the castle's outer close, and again, this also dates back to the days of the Stuart dynasty. At that time, more than 500 years ago, it was full of workshops servicing the needs of the royal court itself. But as we head through this little archway here to the right here, we'll be heading up to the castle's inner close and then into the Douglas Gardens, which is the highest point of the castle rock itself.
So what are we going to see from there?
We shall see around us as we head through this
mist.
Archway.
Lots of mist today.
We shall see the castle's main royal buildings from the days of the Stuart dynasty.
I mean, Edinburgh Castle's bigger than this, but not much bigger than this. You know, and there's something about this, possibly because it was also a royal palace. It's got a richness about it that Edinburgh Castle doesn't have.
That's correct, yeah. And with all due respect to our colleagues at Edinburgh Castle,
lovely people,
we have to do this, as you say, is combining both being a fortress and a royal residence as well here. And if we look to our left here, actually, just, Jim, we can see actually the King himself up here. Among these statues we have Saturn and Venus, and these represent the golden age of peace, prosperity and justice during King James V's reign at that time. We're coming through this wee archway here into the Douglas Garden.
Oh, here we go.
This is the highest point of the Castle Rock here. This is where the original medieval castle would have been located from the 12th century onwards, in the reign of Alexander I.
Can't see any view yet. There's a big high wall.
Yeah. Yes, there we go. The wall walk. But we'll take a wee walk on that shortly. If I could just draw your attention to this just now, Mark and Ewan, it's the reason why it's called the Douglas Gardens is because of this incident that took place here at the castle on the 22nd of February of 1452. It was when King James II, or the Fiery Face, murdered William the 8th Earl of Douglas. Stabbed him to death 26 times that night.
And it says on the information board, from the Auchinleck Chronicle, the king said, "False traitor," and stert suddenly till him with a knife.
That's correct.
Take that, ooh, yeah.
And then hurled him out that window.
Hurled him out that window, apparently.
Okay.
Is the legend itself there. So hence known as the Douglas Gardens.
It's a lovely wee oasis of camp. It doesn't feel part of the castle at all. It's beautiful mature.
That's very true, Ewan. It is a lovely oasis. It's a nice place to come and just enjoy a few moments on a busy day. And again, you're still talking to visitors and such like when you're up here too. Yeah. But you were looking to catch some of the scenery from the castle. Let's take a wee walk under the wall walk here in the Douglas Garden. Normally the view is spectacular, but of course, with it being a bit misty around about the hills today.
Listen, the motto of this programme is you should have been here yesterday.
That's correct, yeah.
I bet you it was glorious. Yeah, I knew that. That is some view. Look at that. That's brilliant.
About the origins of the River Forth, and of course, as it winds its way up, all the way up from up here, going to the left, going up towards the Trossachs as well.
See, the thing that surprised me, when our producer Laura said we're going to do the first bit at Stirling Castle, and I thought, well, Stirling Castle's on the north side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
We're wrong.
Yes, it's on the south side. That's correct, yeah.
So where's the river?
Well, let's take a look along the... Something else to draw your attention to is this little spy hole here to our left.
Uh-huh.
It's said to have been used by the young Mary, Queen of Scots, when she was a child queen here at the castle.
Okay.
Back in the 1540s.
We are on essentially the west side of the castle here at the moment, and you're looking up the Carse of Stirling, which is basically just rows and rows of fields.
Yeah.
It's this great flat valley just disappearing off into the mist today. You've got some of the Stirling suburbs down below us, etc. And the motorway. Obviously, you can hear the motorway.
That's correct. We come to this platform here, and we'll get an even better view looking down below the castle and getting a better view of the River Forth itself.
Of all the rivers in Scotland, to my mind, this is the one, you know, when we talk about Oxbow rivers, this is the one that best fits the description. It just wanders about like a drunken cow.
It's just slow meandering across the country. But is that why the castle's here? Why was the castle here?
That's exactly it. It's strategically placed, overlooking the lowest crossing point of the River Forth and controlling north to south in those days. Because in the Middle Ages, as you said yourself, with it being largely boggy marshland around about the castle, going across the Forth, alleged to go northwards, southwards, the castle's built overlooking that part of the Forth there, and so it's very strategic. It's been said that he who held Stirling Castle could hold Scotland itself. That's how important the castle was from the 12th century onwards.
And the river's not just a barrier, it's also a supply route.
That's correct, yeah. Until about the mid-20th century, there was a harbour below the castle in the River Forth, about a mile below the castle, yeah. And that was still active until about the mid-20th century.
Because this is about as far as you can go by boat, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah. It's, as you come this way here, it really does narrow, and get a lot narrower as you come all the way around to the left here. And indeed, the local legend has it that the river, as it winds, spells its own name of the Forth.
It's not been a wasted trip after
local
all.
Legend. That's the local legend.
You'll hear that at dinner parties all across Scotland in years to come.
Whether there's any truth to that or not, I'm not sure, no.
Well, we'll have to have a look at a map. And presumably, that's why a lot of people wanted this castle. That was why there's so many battles.
Exactly. Well, we can show you a prime example of that just now as we walk to the right here along the rest of the wall walk here. Still above the Douglas Gardens, but as we come along here, we can see to the left and down below both Stirling Bridge and this tower, which of course is the National Wallace Monument.
Okay, aye, I can see it, yep.
That's the later, we believe, 15th century stone bridge, because the wooden bridge was destroyed on the day of the battle itself. The battle I'm talking about is the Battle of Stirling Bridge, fought down there on September the 11th of 1297, so 720 years ago next month. And where the Wallace Monument is located today is where Wallace commanded his army from that morning. Yeah.
The thing is about, you know, you look at a river that isn't particularly deep and you think, well, okay, how difficult can it be? When you're running around swathed in bits of metal, probably nearly twice your own weight, a river's not a good thing to be near.
No, it is not, no. And we believe that the river at that time would have been a wee bit wider as well, and possibly a wee bit deeper too.
The rain's still falling and thousands of people are still streaming in to see this place.
It's just a wall of different voices and accents. It's incredible. We're going to meet an old friend of the programme as well.
Indeed, indeed. She's more or less on a personal retainer nowadays, Linda Whiteford. Something of a regular on River Forth programmes.
Okay, so I have a wee taste test here for you.
Okay.
Okay. So, first off...
Immediately, you and leaps forward.
It's a strange way to start an interview.
You might remember these.
I do remember that. Okay. This is the bloody Plowman's, isn't it?
Have a wee bit of that. Oh, there you go. Okay.
It's an apple.
Is it all right?
Yeah,
from...
Nice apple. This is from Coors Palace Garden. Okay, now...
It's all from the garden, is it?
Yes. Be aware of the colours. Lovely, beautiful red apple. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now... Bearing in mind that Scottish people would have been eating things like you've just eaten for a long time, okay. A wee bit on the Welsh side, perhaps?
It's slightly sharp.
Yeah.
Yep.
You're very kind. Right.
Because it turns up.
Try this.
Blood-stained red when you bite into it.
That's the best bit. Right, have a bit of that.
Okay, pear.
Tastes like lovely.
But beautiful, sweet.
Yep.
Watch a good
pear. That's a Jargonelle pear.
Mmm.
France.
That's very nice.
And then laterally, lovely little apricot here. Mm-hmm. Beautiful sunshine orange colour. Okay, this is from the garden.
Grown outside?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Right, have a piece of that.
Because you do have a fantastic wall garden there.
Yes, and it's done really well this year. Amazing apples and pears and quinces and figs even, but they're not quite ripe yet, so I wouldn't do that to you. This was the last one on the tree, so it's had a long time sitting there. But anyway,
it's got a nice sweetness, isn't it?
The colour.
I'd be pleased with that. The colours are fantastic.
Yes. So what I'm getting at is that for years and years and years, people had just the fruits and vegetables that were here. So anything with a bit of sweetness was seen as being really exotic. And boy, did the wealthy folk really want those sweet and exotic things. And that's why they had big walled gardens next to their estates.
Which leads us nicely to a pineapple, which we're not going to be tasting.
No! So, sorry about that.
Close the boot up and we'll take a turn up and have a shift.
Apples.
Yeah, of course. You can take the lot home with you if you like. Right, we're at the Dunmore Pineapple at Airth. Basically, it's inside a walled garden, about 6 acres big. Mm-hmm. And there's actually two walled gardens here. But it was originally built to go with Elphinstone Tower. The Barony of Elphinstone was here from 16th century. And basically this was to go with that. The trees are huge. There's even one tree that's listed, this one just in front of us here, yes. Basically, the pineapple building, when we get in front of it, we'll see as we walk around on the path, there's paths everywhere here. It's a great place for a walk.
It's a huge walled garden.
Yes. But do you know, the walls are here to raise the temperature because it's south-facing.
And it works.
There's only walls on three sides. But it's to raise the temperature so that you can grow things that you don't, that would be frost-free basically all year round. The bottom part of it was built in 1761. As we go around, you'll see it's a giant pineapple.
So was this the just general like fruit, or is an element to show it off here?
It's Look, all about showing off. It's all about showing off, Ewan. It's really all about showing off. So now we can see the front of the building. And you see, it's basically, it started off as two gardener's bothies on either side of the giant pineapple structure in 1761. And our gardener thinks that that may well have been, and I love saying this, it was a ha-ha.
Right, okay.
Okay, which was like a viewing platform. John Murray, who built this, the Earl of Dunmore, he became the Earl of Dunmore. and it was he who built this. And they think that the ha-ha, that was there before the pineapple was built. The pineapple was built when he came back from being governor of New York, the Bahamas, and Virginia. And he'd obviously seen pineapples on his travels out there. He may well have grown them out in the Bahamas, but he came back, built the pineapple part to commemorate the marriage of his son to Susan Douglas Hamilton. And gosh, that was you marrying, that was the Dunmores marrying into the one of the most prestigious families in Scotland.
Quality.
And so how did you show off? You showed off by building a pineapple, 46 foot high pineapple.
How would your daughters react? You would go, oh, Dad, no, it's horrible.
I've built your pineapple, darling.
No, but you see, society in Edinburgh were actually hiring pineapples to put on their dinner tables to show off. Hiring pineapples.
So you had a pineapple one night and you gave it back the next day?
Yeah, it was so exotic and so delicious and so sweet. And this was a heck of a wedding present. And it's all in proportion.
Just in terms of construction, the leaves at the bottom, I don't know, they must be about... a metre long, curving out from the building. Yeah. Must be just physically getting them to stay there.
It's
quite
a wonder of masonry. I mean, the stone masons that made that were absolute masters of the craft.
Well, I think I wandered up.
Each one of the leaves and each one of the wee nodule bits on the pineapple have been graded so well that not one drop of water sits on them, so there's no chance of getting any frost damage there. It's just a masterpiece.
Because that was my initial thought. As I came in, that's going to fill up with water.
It would be beautiful if it was. It would be like a big fountain.
Yes, that pineapple will rot.
Interesting what you're saying about the ha-ha, though, because... Yeah. Well, a ha-ha basically was a drop in a piece of ground initially.
Hide a fence.
Well, it could hide a wall or something of the kind, but the idea was you could be moving through the landscape and all of a sudden you fell down into this invisible ditch, hence the name ha-ha.
But the thing is that we're now going up a wee slope. See, this is this is one level.
Yeah.
They took away part of the earth and they raised the back of it. So where the pavilion is, where the conservatory bit looks like halfway up the building, that's the other level of the ground behind the building.
Right.
So there is a bit of a drop, if you see what I mean.
Okay.
That is a magnificent piece of carving.
Built at different times, but with the same stone.
Well, I mean, it's sandstone. I mean, it is absolutely correct in every detail.
Yeah.
But as you say, what would be the green short leaves down at the bottom that carve out and round? Yeah. That's just superb.
It's amazing. And we've got a pigeon, a dew on the top.
Aye.
They like to sit up there. But do you know what else? They reckon it was William Chambers who designed and built this. Now, he was famous for buildings at Kew Gardens and Dundas House, where the Royal Bank of Scotland is, and Somerset House. So he was a master of his art. Yes. Yeah. But and so the Grecian urns as well. These Grecian urns had been actually moved over the years, but they were chimneys, okay?
Right.
Very, very posh chimneys.
Wow, okay.
These walls inside are hollow, okay? So they were heated walls. Amazing.
Just this bit or the whole bit?
The whole bit. There were pipes going all the way along.
You've got to admire it. The scale.
Yeah, it's now beginning to look like not a bad wedding present, you know. Initially insane, but...
also, the early Georgians, they were beginning to be able to make bigger panes of glass. Mm-hmm. So there were glass houses here too, latterly.
Okay.
1970, the Dunmore estate was being split up. Mm-hmm. Countess of Perth bought parts of it, and she very kindly donated this part, the pineapple part, to the National Trust for Scotland. Mm-hmm. And in turn, we leased out the building and the repair work of the building to the Landmark Trust, and they rent it out as a holiday home.
Okay.
So you've got two gardener's bothies as one kind of holiday home. One side you've got the lounge and the kitchen, and the other side you've got the bathroom and the two bedrooms. Mm-hmm. So you actually have to go outside to get to the other side.
Andy.
But they are fantastic. It's a wee fantastic place to stay.
The pineapple was used as a symbol for colonial travellers as well.
Yes. Christopher Columbus, they say, discovered the pineapple in 1493. Well, he might have discovered it, but people in Guadeloupe found it first.
Yeah.
And he basically brought it back to Europe. But it was a real... I mean, it was amazing because it was so sweet and so unusual looking that everybody sort of took up on it and used it for designs and architecture and prints and flowers. And it was quite easy to grow. If you kept it warm, it was really, really easy to grow. You cut the top off, put it in water, and it starts to shoot. Yeah. So lots of people were trying that. But nobody... used it as a building.
They use it as a symbol, say, actually, we're home.
When
they came back from sea, they would put a pineapple on the gatepost. Say, hey, we've been abroad, but now we're back.
and were open to receiving guests, so people would know they could come and visit. And a lot of the artists and that picked that up and used it as symbols. So you see it in a lot of railings and gateposts, especially in Edinburgh.
Charlotte Square and things like
especially
that.
Especially in Edinburgh, yeah.
Well, that's William Chambers again, building Dundas House.
But so is this open to the public?
Yes, it's open from dawn till dusk.
It must be said, this isn't the easiest place to find.
You just got to know how to get there. Signposted from Airth.
Are folk aware of it, or is it like us? Just something you drive past and say, I wonder what that is.
Well, I've driven past the sign umpteen times, but I've never actually seen it.
Well, it's a great place to walk. There's lots of woodland paths around here.
This is Willie Anderson from the Kincardine Historical Society, and we're in his... Well, I've never been in one of these Robin Reliance before.
I've never been in a three-wheel car before, so this is all quite exciting stuff.
Yeah, indeed. You're kind of passionate about these cars.
No, I've only got a motorbike licence. You can drive these on a motorbike licence.
All this information that would have been really useful before we left the car park.
But my old laddie, the oldest laddie was learning to drive, his mother and him worked on me. I had a motorbike sidecar. And they worked on me to buy a three-wheeler so that he could sit and learn to drive. He was taking lessons, but it was also to help him out.
The reason we've got into the car is because we want to cross the Kincardine Bridge in some style. I'm taking my glasses off because they were steaming up with terror. Tell me about this bridge.
The bridge was much better years ago when George... was the bridge master. It was kept. It was called the Silver Link, and it was well painted. It was well maintained, and it was a silver link. It was lovely, but since they took the bridge master off the bridge, it's gradually deteriorating. You'll see it when you see the centre span. There's places where the paint has gone green with mould.
Yeah. You know. So take us back a bit, Willie. When was it built? Why was it built?
It was built 1936. It was opened. And there was a ferry across the river at that time, and this was a replacement for the ferry.
We're on the Kincardine Bridge itself. Now, this might be my imagination, but I think I can remember crossing this as a wee boy with my dad in the car, and there was like a ticket booth or something, was there? Was there somebody sat there?
No. It was always a free bridge.
There is an office in the middle, if you look up above us now.
That's the central console where the operating mechanism for turning the bridge was.
Because originally it pivoted.
It turned. It was the biggest double-span swing bridge in Europe. But George was quite a character, the bridge master. He gave a talk to the local history group one time, and he told you a few anecdotes about the bridge. And one of them was that the St Andrews bus used to stop in the village for 10 minutes. And the conductors and the driver got a cup of tea in the cafe. And she met George and she says to him, I've never seen this bridge open. Oh, he says, you shouldn't have said that, hen. He says, for now on, you'll get stopped time and time again. So he says, about a month later, he says, I was turning the bridge. He says, and I heard the peep, peep, peep. And I looked down. He says, and there she was at the door of the bus waving to me. And he says, for the next couple of months, he says, she got stopped about three times. So in the end, she says to me, look, would you stop opening that bridge? Because when you open the bridge, we lose our time and we can't stop for our cup of tea.
What was the bridge opening to let through?
Ships going up to Alloa and Stirling.
Okay. Big ships?
A reasonable size. The ammunition depot at Throsk. Okay. Their munition ship went up once a month and it was open for that. And as the ship came up to the bridge, he peeped three times. And if the bridge answered back, he kept on sailing. If the bridge didn't answer back, he had to stop and anchor.
Okay.
It's a very unique sort of... It's almost like an American bridge with that building on the top of it. It's very different to most of the bridges you'll see in the UK.
Well, one of his sons lived in America and he was across in America and he says, we came to a bridge, an opening bridge, and he says, the traffic was stopped and we got out and we're having a look. And he says, somebody heard me talking and he says, where do you come from? And he says, I come from Scotland. He says, do you know the Kincardine Bridge? He says, I'm the bridge master. And he says, he shouted to all his pals, hey, he says, he's the bridge master of the Kincardine Bridge. And he says, there they knew about the Kincardine Bridge. He says, it's world famous.
What I love about this is just the lampposts are very sort of
very stylish.
Very Art Deco style. It's
Art Deco.
Art Deco.
Charles Henry McIntosh.
But also, if you compare it to its rival there, the other bridge.
The Clackmannanshire Bridge.
It's a poor
replica.
It's a very dull, boring bridge, whereas this one's full of character.
This, what I always say is that this is one of the only bridges that doesn't shut in a high wind. Uh-huh. I mean, this bridge is open all the time. It never stops. It was a minor information, George. He was a good laugh, you know.
I always think it's interesting, though, because this predates the road, the fourth road bridge, which was, what, mid-60s, by almost 40 years. Yeah, but people forget about these bridges.
Aye. He told us there was a before his time, there was an American destroyer came up the river, and he came up and he signalled and he said, how far is it to the fourth bridge? He had been told to pass the fourth bridge in anchor at Rosyth.
But it must have revolutionised transport when it went up.
Oh, it did. My mother says that when she used to go to the dancing in Falkirk, they had to go by train across the Alwa Bridge. And she says, once the Kincardine Bridge, you got the bus across. I mind getting stopped once during the war. My grandfather lived in Alwa and we lived in Larbert, and the Home Guard was on the bridge during the war and checked your identity cards.
And they were very thankful for it when the Fourth Road Bridge closed.
Every time there's an accident, it's as busy as anything here. I mean, you can hardly get across.
Uh-huh. Have you ever cowped the robin?
Yes.
Oh, God. What happens when you cowp the robin?
You just stick it back up on its wheels and drive on.
Is it easy to do?
Aye.
Not with four people in it, it's not.
This one was cowped early on this year. Uh-huh. I was going round the roundabout across the other side of the Bearsdyke Road. Uh-huh. And I came round the thing, and there must have been either ice or grease on the road, and it flipped on its side. And a woman come rushing up. She said, you all right? And I says, I'm fine. She said, you're no bleed, you want an ambulance? I says, no. She says, oh, really? I says, I am okay. So a fella came over, a lorry driver, and he says, you want a tow? I said, no, just give me a hand to roll it back. And I climbed out that door, rolled it back up and climbed in, turned the key, and they're all looking, you know, and they drove away. That was it. It was all scarred on one side.
We've got out of the Robin Reliant, and...
Well, you glossed over that. That was no easy task.
Holding
ourselves
out, shaking in terror.
No. I now know what the tarmac here tastes like because I got down and kissed it. Never mind the Robin Reliant. Getting back to the bridge, the Kincardine Bridge, and the river. How busy was the river?
It was quite busy. There was a steamer service for Stirling to Leith, and then you had the other shipping traffic going up and down. I mean, well, Alloway, you had the distillery, you had the glassworks, the exported glass. A lot of it went by ship. In the 1700s, they were sailing mostly to the Baltic. Mm-hmm. And the graveyard up the road, great carved stones in it, and you'll get two trades on the one stone. And it was because the Baltic was closed in the winter with ice, so they had to have another trade. So there would be maybe a cobbler or something else. Mm. So you had two trades, and as far as we know, it's quite unique to Kincardine. Mm. There was salt works here, and they exported salt. And it was quite a busy port, you know.
Was it quite controversial? Because it doesn't open anymore, does it?
No.
Was it controversial when they closed that aspect
really,
down?
Because the shipping had almost finished by that time. The Navy place up at the Thrust had closed, so there was no need for ammunition going up.
I mean, this is a community that's really built on the River Forth. Has it turned its back on the River Forth now?
Yes. Because, I mean, I had a great uncle that sailed out of New Haven, and he came up to visit me one time, and he said that he came up here with his father, turned the century fishing, and he says, oh, it's a rich place, Kincardine. There's a lot of ships' captains, he says. Oh, and in the rain hooses, he says. You know, which at that time was quite unusual, Ken. No, it was a busy, busy port, you know.
It's looking a bit unloved now. Oh, you've got the big new shiny crossing. The fourth road bridge still looks quite impressive and looked after, and you've got the rail bridge resplendent. The bridge here looks really uncared for.
It is. It's neglected. As I said to you going out behind me, when George was the bridge master, there was 10 of your staff, and it was maintained. You would see them painting from time to time, and if it got rusty, they would chip it back and paint it, you know. Mm. It was well maintained. The roads were swept, the pavements were kept clean, and for some reason or other, they got rid of the staff, and that's it.
See, I didn't hear you saying that, crossing the bridge, because it was kind of drowned out by the praying coming from the back seat.
Chicken. Wimp.
Willie Anderson, and hand on heart, it's been a long time since I've been so frightened in a vehicle.
It was one of those things. We came out and we saw the three-wheeler. And I said, Never been in one of them. Good idea to do the interview in the car.
You idiot.
30 seconds later, I'm in the back seat thinking, what a stupid idea that was.
This is Skin Flats. We're here with Tom Churchard, who's the programme manager for the Inner Forth Landscape Initiative. It is really diverse in terms of plant life. I mean, you know, we're surrounded by butterflies and things here.
I'm just going to leave it in here, Tom. There is a sea of thistles, and there is 50...
More butterflies than I've seen this year.
Peacock butterflies, red admirals, are they? There's one over there.
Yeah, we've hit it really well. This previous week has just been an explosion of life. And as you said, I think something that people don't realise is we're kind of in this heart of industrial Scotland here, but the Inner Forth and the Forth itself is just actually teeming with wildlife when you stop and look. I think stopping and looking is a thing. So many people pass through the Inner Forth, they're going up to the Highlands, they're travelling between cities, they're commuting, and I guess a big thing that we're doing through the Inner Forth Landscape Initiative is just asking people really just to stop a little bit and have a look and see what's on your doorstep.
But the point you were making is, well, we've just driven over the bridge and you see this vast expanse of thick black mud and you think, you know, this is post-industrial desert, this is awful. And then 5 minutes, you're just teeming with wildlife.
It is teeming with wildlife, and that thick black mud that looks kind of, as you say, this kind of post-industrial desert is actually this kind of huge resource for tens and tens of thousands of wild birds. And so this whole area, it's designated as a Ramsar site, an SPA, so it's really important. And during the summer and the spring, there's breeding birds here, but particularly in the winter, and now as we come into autumn, tens of thousands of waders that are migrating south from further north come through here and stop and just kind of, this is like, it's a massive fast food restaurant, basically, out there.
I wondered, actually, just how accidental, you know, how much happened chance, effectively, this is. Because it is a post-industrial landscape. Therefore, to a certain extent, it is neglected. And where it is neglected, nature steps in. I mean, has it done this by itself? How much help has it had?
So, it's a bit of both. I think nature will always have been here. And we'll always kind of, nature's tenacious, we'll always take advantage of the opportunities that it is there. And, you know, nature wants to be here for the same reason that humans want to be here. You know, the resources that are around, the mudflats, this far up the Forth used to be incredibly important for trading routes previously, before kind of a lot of the trade shifted east towards Edinburgh. So I think nature's always been here. And it's just reconnecting people to realise that it's there.
You were talking about this is nature taking it back, but there was a lot of help given to nature here. I was here, feels like 5 years ago, it might have been a lot more. And this was just a pile of mud and diggers. There was a lot of work going on.
Yep, so what we're looking at here, this is an area that is managed by the RSPB. And it used to just be a field here until through management and kind of getting diggers on site and all that kind of big ugly stuff happening and opening up to start to allow salt water back in. It's just kind of, you know, giving this area that bit of a head start rather than just kind of leaving it for too long. We can just nudge it on a bit and get it going. And now it's doing it all by itself.
You were talking earlier about the point of this really being to try and encourage local people to, you know, to re-engage with the wildlife that's on their doorstep and things. How hard a sell is that? Do they believe you?
Yes. The quick short
eventually,
answer is yes. I think people inevitably, we all now carry screens, we expect to see everything through a screen, and everything, all of our pressures are telling us to, like, not look at what is going on around us. Mm-hmm. It's to look at what's happening on a screen in front of you. When you're at work, you're being bombarded by loads and loads of different things. And actually, I guess our message is just take 5 minutes of your day and just look at what is happening around you. And when you give a little bit of time to stop and look, you start seeing huge amounts of things of interest and beauty that are happening around you. And it's such a simple thing to kind of encourage people to do that it doesn't take that many people to start doing it, when actually it's not a really difficult sell. We work with a number of partners along the Forth, and there's just so much going on here. The natural heritage, cultural heritage as well. And seeing it all together and just sort of becoming reconnected with the place is quite an exciting journey to experience.
It's a seriously muddy section here. Somebody has been putting in stakes and I'm putting in a lot of sort of, you know, brashings round about it. You can see how thick and gloopy the mud is there, heading off down towards the Forth. As you say, an incredibly rich environment.
Yes, incredibly rich. So although it looks kind of flat and barren from where we're standing now, if we were to kind of get some waders on and go out and have a dig around,
We'd sink without trace.
But we'd see all sorts of things whilst we were
the
sinking.
Way down.
You see quite a lot of the seabirds there, just milling around, raking about in the mud. I don't know what they are from that sun's in our eyes. But...
Black-headed gulls, these ones. Okay. So they breed around the area and they're just sort of now fueling up for the winter.
Come and stand here. You're looking out towards the Kincardine Bridge, Clackmannanshire Bridge, etc. There's the Ochil Hills, just spread out in front of you. Kincardine across there. Then mudflats, right the way down to Longannet. You've got more industrial works down on that right-hand side there, etc. But it's just, it's such an open landscape. It's big skies.
You can see the bridges, am I imagining? Oh, I can. I can see the rail bridge.
Yeah.
And the road bridge. And the third crossing as well. Yeah. Through the mist. I'm saying it's a horrible black post-industrial desert. There is something hypnotic, magical about that glistening mud that you suddenly will be covered in water.
Well, the great cooling tower at Longannet, you know, the chimneys there, you know, and the large building, that's both been reflected, you know, in that very, very thin skin of water on top of the mud. Yeah. It's bonny.
So where do you go next? What's the next plan?
So the Inner Forth Landscape Initiative, we're lottery funded and we're 3 years through a 4-year programme, so we have another year left. Almost spent it all, yeah. We're trying hard to spend it all.
What would you hope to achieve once at the end of the project?
There's sort of big things that we hope to achieve and we feel that we kind of are on the way to achieving. Really a greater sense of pride in place, where local people kind of get sense of pride and more enjoyment out of the delights of where they live. Greater recognition from people passing through that this isn't an area that you just need to pass through. You can stop, even if it's just to break your journey up going elsewhere, stop, have an afternoon or a day in the Inner Forth. There's plenty to see here. And also, we're working as a partnership between a lot of the local authorities and charities, taking those kind of working practices forward for the Inner Forth, instead of everything being so disjointed, really treating this as a really great place.
I am Jeff Bailey, I'm the archaeologist for Falkirk Community Trust, and I'm based in Callander House.
Callander House is magnificent, it's behind us, we're actually walking away from it at the moment, and it's got... Never mind Scottish baronial, it's got slight hints of French chateau, actually. It's a very interesting building.
It is. What you see today only really dates to the 1860s and 1870s, but it's a sham over an original tower house belonging to the 15th century, which in itself replaces a timber hall at the opposite end of the park, which dates to the 8th century. So a long history of occupation by the magnates on this site.
We've come away from the River Forth at the moment to have a shufti at this, because, I mean, Callander Park sits more or less just in the outskirts of Falkirk, but you've got a lot of history here.
Well, the park itself has an Iron Age hill fort. We've got the Dark Age timber hall. We've got the Roman wall, which is the thing that we're going to go and have a look at the moment. The odd thing is the Roman wall only lasted for 20 years, and yet it's a massive scar across the landscape, which then became a feature of the later parkland.
OK. When we're talking about a wall, how big was the wall? Describe it to me.
Yes, a lot of tourists think that they will see a stone wall as you do on Hadrian's Wall. Uh-huh. Our wall was made from turf and from earth with a massive ditch in the front of it. And our ditch is twice the size of that on Hadrian's Wall.
And was it actually designed to keep people out? You know, would it have worked in that regard?
It has a lot of defensive capability. It has a lot of what we call passive defensive features. So there are hidden traps and pits. And yes, it would have been quite effective at particularly small-scale movement. But as with the Maginot Line, it would have been quite easy to concentrate your forces and punch a hole through it.
Yeah. But very much the river was part of the reason for the wall being built where it is.
The wall is 38 miles long, so it goes all the way from the Forth over at Carradon near Bowness right through to Old Kilpatrick on the Clyde. So it has to follow the natural east-west ridges. And in this particular case, we're climbing now the glacial Esker at the front of the parkland, and the wall just follows that bank.
Mm-hmm. But would the river been part of the defences?
Here, the Forth is almost a mile to the north, but you can see it from the wall, and of course, it's much easier to see enemy troops coming across a flat piece of water like that than it is through the hills in the central part of the wall.
And the wall itself, presumably there were forts along the length of it. How were they spaced? How many were there?
There are 17 known forts along the Antonine Wall, so that's one at approximately every 2 mile intervals. Mm-hmm. The last one that we discovered was back in 1991 in Falkirk town centre itself.
Seriously, in the town centre?
As close as that. It's within a stone's throw of the shopping centre.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, if it's every 2 miles apart, if they raised the alarm, by the time everybody got the clobber organised and what have you, you're basically looking at nearly half an hour before help can get to you.
Well, every fort would have approximately 500 soldiers in it, and between those you may have people outstationed at fortlets. So, say, 50 people in a fortlet between those 2 mile intervals. Uh-huh. So, small-scale incursions you could deal with more or less on the spot. Anything like that, larger than that, you need to muster your troops. And Falkirk has a very large concentration of forts because it's on the main road northwards as well, through Camlan and up to Perth.
So this is the wall, presumably. You've got a big trench?
Yes, what we see in front of us is the remnant of the ditch, which here is about 50 feet wide. And today it's only about 10 feet deep because the bottom part has been filled in. Originally, about 16 feet in depth. And we did excavate a section through the ditch just the other side of the wall garden to our east over there. And there we managed to get down to the full depth.
Yeah, I bet you that's quite impressive when you see it. It's not something you're going to scamper across easily.
You can't jump across it with a horse, that's for sure. In the bottom of the ditch, there was a square slot, about a foot square, with vertical sides, dug into the relatively soft gravel. And that suggests that it had been backfilled by the Romans almost immediately after it had been dug. Mm-hmm. And we think it would have contained branches, like a hawthorn hedge, which would have then formed a kind of entanglement at the bottom of the ditch. Mm-hmm. So not only do you have to jump across the ditch, you have to jump over this hedge.
I'm not quite getting it yet. We're on a bit of high ground.
Yep.
We've got a ditch, and then we've got a mound, yes, and it falls away down towards the river. Which bit's the wall and which bit's the ditch?
We're actually standing on the rampart itself, but because that was made of turf or earth, that's the stuff that gets ploughed away and levelled completely.
So it would have been considerably higher than where we are at the moment?
Yeah, the rampart itself would be 14 feet wide at the base and about 10 feet high. So, you know, you've got a whole set of barriers through here. And between the ditch and the rampart, on the area which we call the berm, there's a series of defensive pits. These would be about 2 feet deep. And what you do is you cut the large branches from the neighbouring trees. So you've got a branch which splays out like an antler. You embed it in the pit, backfill the pit, and all these branches interlock to form essentially coils of barbed wire. So it's an entanglement.
Organic barbed wire, I like it.
Well, that's what you have in that period. And on the lip of the ditch, you have a dry stone dike, so as you're trying to pull yourself out of the ditch, it falls on top of you. So that's the booby trap. You know, so this is quite a formidable obstacle.
Clever people, these Romans.
Well, it means that you require fewer people to actually man it, because they're passive defences.
Mark and I have glibly been calling this the River Forth.
Yes.
And you've got an alternative theory.
The Forth is only a river upstream from Alloa. From Alloa to the Forth Bridge, strictly speaking, it's an estuary. And beyond the Forth Bridge, it's a forth, which is an arm of the sea. And that is the official definition.
Horse feathers. just turning round behind me, you know, you can see past the Rowan Tree and between the sycamore, etc., the kelpies, and the rips are not the river, the estuary is behind that. Between us and the water, there's what's known as the karst. Now, how important was that historically?
The karst is very important for the town of Falkirk and this entire region because it's the rich fluvial land which is used for arable cultivation. So it provides not only the livelihood for the local people, but also for the occupying force through here. And we know that trapped underneath the upcast mound from the 99 wall, there is a good quality cultivation soil. Later on, there was a saying in this part of the world that Turner the Fourth was worth an earldom in the north because of the superior quality of the land here.
The Antonine Wall, still something of a feature in the landscape. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy, and this week...
Yeah, we're doing something really quite exciting. This is a follow-on from our fourth programme. We're on the south side now, and it's just been a voyage to discovery so far, because we've got a secret tunnel.
Aye, we've been talking about bridges over the Forth, and despite the fact that I spent part of my boyhood in Bowness, I was unaware of the fact that there'd actually been a tunnel right the way underneath the Forth. And one of the engineers on that was Alistair Moore. We're here in the library at Bowness. How did it come about?
Vanifield Colliery is an old colliery, and it got condemned by the Mines Inspectorate for the pit head because it was rusted through, and they gave them 6 months to get it replaced. And the engineering management, they suggested that we should close it and transfer all the coal that came up from Valleyfield into Kinneil workings and into Kinneil Colliery pit head.
Which sounds straightforward, but Valleyfield is on that side of the Forth and Kinneil is on this side of the Forth.
Yeah, but there's nothing impossible.
But it was surely the obvious thing to do, not to build a bridge to transport that coal.
The cost would be ginormous. So we've got a halfway across from via Kinneil workings and a third of the way across from Valleyfield, join them up.
So the existing coal mine actually came halfway across the Forth from here, a third of the way across from the other side, and you basically needed to join those two up.
We'll say fractions like that.
Aye.
And it was a question of joining the two up, reversing the Valleyfield machinery so that the conveyors, instead of running north, ran south into the Kinneil workings.
A moment of genius on somebody's part.
Yeah, it was not any particular person's part. We all did our share.
Let's have a shift at this, because you brought down this map. Can you give us a hand with this? Because this is not just a big map. This is
a huge map.
It's a huge map.
And that's the reason we're actually inside at the moment, in the library.
Yep.
Oh,
that's a lead weight.
Sure is.
Take it right away along to the...
Keep going. This is a long map.
One in each corner.
Okay. Right.
Wow.
Where is the river? Because what we're looking at is a map of what was under the ground.
Right. There's high water mark, and you'll find low water mark.
Okay. So all these areas were existing mine workings?
Yeah, these are all where coal has been extracted.
You basically ran the tunnel and connected it where? Here, presumably?
No. There's the point of connection there.
Wow. Okay.
Now, when we were working that coal there, that's the Blair Hall Main, this is all just one seam, this. Mm-hmm. When we were working the Blair Hall Main on this side, Valleyfield, when Valleyfield was working separately, working from there.
Geology is never tidy, so presumably it wasn't just a case of connecting up. These would have been at different levels as well.
This is a different level. You can see the contours. Uh-huh. The contours are dipping, are rising here very steeply, as you can see this gap mm-hmm. between them, as opposed to down here where the contours have levelled out a bit.
How did you transport the coal? Was it a conveyor belt or was it locomotives?
This mine here is locomotives. Mm-hmm.
What was it like the moment when it actually connected the two sides?
Well, what happened was I was going on holiday. We checked the levels and we knew they were within a foot, we'd be connecting within a foot and that would be okay. But it was, how far away are we? And how can I check this out? And my measurement said that it was about 30 or 40 feet to go to get the connection. Well, I said to the manager on the Friday, by the way, Mr. Archibald, I'm going off on holiday. No, you're not. Okay. So anyway, on the Friday night, I took my wife and the two youngsters, Anthony and Alistair, up to Granny's up in Rhiney and came back. And on the Sunday, I went round all the pits that I could and a radius. And I begged and borrowed, I didn't steal, but I begged and borrowed 5-foot-long extension rods for the drilling apparatus. And I got, it was 9, I think I got. So I had 54 feet of extra drilling, providing the drill was
up to the job.
Up to the job. But it only bored the hole yay size. And I left a note for the deputy that was in charge of the drivage that I would be down about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning. And for him to keep putting on extension rods. So I went down and had, I think, they had 2 extra rods on. And I think we put on altogether 5 drills. And I'm thinking to myself, we're way out here now. And the noise was, as I say, you couldn't properly speak. And all of a sudden, there was woof and whine.
No resistance.
No resistance. It was through.
That must have been a right sense of relief.
Oh. I'd spoken to one of the under managers at Valleyfield, was on duty on the Sunday, and I said to him what I was planning to do. Could he make a point of being at the other side? They thought they were where they should be because they could hear. You can hear noises down the pit. And he was at the other side. So when he'd got this hole bored and saw the drill coming through, he was able to walk up to the drill. To the hole, and I, hello, that's the usual signal, and put an ear to the hole, and I got the hello back, and that was it. So I said to the under manager at Valleyfield side, I said, what is the measurement from the pavement of the mine that you were driving to the hole? And he said, 4 feet and about 3 inches. I said, that'll do me. 4 feet's fine. Because that's what I had
set
the hole at the Keneal side. I'd set it 4 feet off the pavement, Keneal side.
That's 3 inches. 3 inches out.
It was 3 inches.
Does the tunnel still exist nowadays?
No.
No. Flooded now?
No, it's all filled in. Well, not the tunnels, but the shafts are solid.
It's a shame, isn't it?
It would have been fascinating to actually cross from one side of the Forth to the other side of the Forth via tunnel. But I knew absolutely nothing about it. Thank you very much for talking us through this.
Just one other thing. As soon as I knew the hole was made connection and whatnot, I went up the pit, got myself washed, went into the manager's office and told him the score. And I said, I'd be okay if I go on holiday. Are you no staying? I said, no, if I can help. I said, I'm away from family up in Aberdeenshire. I would like to be with them. So I went out the door. I said, I'll see you a fortnight's time. No, you won't. I said, I'll see you in 3 weeks. So I got an extra week.
It's just that wonderful smell of tangle, of iodine.
Iodine and salt. And just lovely. It's a beautiful, calm day. A bit overcast. You can hear the noise of a tanker, that low rumble just ploughing its way up the Forth. You've got Rosyth in front of us and the bridges to the right looking splendid and hopefully nearly completion.
Very, very close. It, as you say, it's an overcast day today, but there's just enough light in the sky for everything to be taken out in silhouette. And then because the water's pretty calm, you've got the reflections of that on the water itself. Now it's South Queensbury again. There's 2 trains crisscrossing. How exciting is that?
It's great.
Anyway, we're going out in the middle of the Forth. It's a family-run operation, essentially, and we're going out with skipper Duncan McRae.
The following short safety announcement.
That's Corby 2, if you call again, this channel when crossing the eastern limits, over.
Lean over or sit from the guardrail with any safety equipment on board. In the unlikely event of an emergency, You will be kept informed and told exactly.
We are going to head down to Inchcolm Island, so first of all, we'll pass under the world famous Forth Railway Bridge, and it'll take us about half an hour to get down to Inchcolm Island.
So, do you go under the new bridge as well at some point?
Yeah, on our return leg, once we leave Inchcolm, we'll come back under all three bridges and then we'll do a turn just past the Queen's Ferry crossing.
Have you noticed a sort of change in business in demand because of the third crossing?
Yeah, there's a lot of interest, a lot more interest than I thought there was going to be of the construction of new bridge.
It's a bridge.
Yeah, because we've got the amazing railway bridge right in front of us, but people are interested in seeing a new bridge getting built.
So, what's happening out on the island today?
Well, the puffins are away now. A lot of people are still asking about the puffins, but they leave about the end of July, beginning of August. There's still a lot of other birds out in the island just now.
Now, just as we're heading out at the moment, you can see a whole variety of other shipping out and about. Who else uses the Firth of Forth nowadays?
The Forth, it's a very busy shipping channel, so we've still got Grangemouth up the top of the river, Rosyth, where the new aircraft carrier got built, and the tugs just on our right, they are for Hound Point Oil Terminal, and we've also got Brayfoot, it's a gas exporting terminal, and also Leith as well.
You must also get busy with yachts as well, because you're passing Boat Ride Girl on the left. There's thousands of yachts. Does it get pretty busy here?
Yeah, we get a lot of yachts in the river. So Wednesday night is the sailing night for Port Edgar Yacht Club. So that's a very busy.
You just get on the river.
Stay out of the way.
Yeah. Does steam give way to sail? No.
Never
in your long-legged life.
It's always might gives way to right.
So what about yourself? How long have you been doing this job?
I've been on this vessel for 20 years. So I'm from up the northwest of Scotland, so I started my career on boats. I used to be a commercial diver and then got into skippering and I've been here ever since.
So what was the attraction of this particular job?
I love working with the public, so before I was always on work boats, so I just love seeing people enjoying their trips. So.
You've nobody to talk to before?
No, lots of friendly people nowadays.
You were talking about the aircraft carrier too. I mean, that must have been magnificent going down the water.
Yeah, it was just a shame it left in the middle of the night, so it was very dark when the ship was leaving the river. I don't know if that was done on purpose, but...
So what's the island in front of us?
This is Inch Garvey in front of us. So these are all old First and Second World War buildings.
See, that's another one. I've never been on that, and every time I go past it, I think, I must go on that. Have you been?
No, I haven't been on there.
Okay.
You get some kayakers, they'll kayak out and they can land on the island, but there's no pier, there's no landing point on the island for getting easy access.
No, that's a pity. Mm. And in terms of general wildlife, how wild does it get out here?
We get amazing bird species. So on the island we were just talking about, we get a lot of fulmars nesting on the island. There's also guillemots. And the gannets, they sometimes come up from the Bass Rock. If we've got strong winds, the gannets will come up and visit us. And the usual puffins and gulls.
So what are folk coming for? Are they coming for the wildlife? They coming for the history?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of everything. They're coming out for... They love seeing the bridges up close, all different angles under the bridge. The wildlife and Inchcolm Island. It's a beautiful island with the 12th century abbey. So I think it's a mix of everything, all types of people coming out.
You never get home, maybe you do get used to it, but just going under the Forth Rail Bridge at the moment.
I never get used to seeing the Forth Railway Bridge.
It's such a structure, it's incredible.
Yeah. It is amazing building.
We were just saying, we were standing in the pier, and you get a real sense of the massiveness of it, standing on the pier, just the hawse in there. You can clearly see it was a response to the fact that the Tay Bridge had collapsed.
Yes,
and the engineers thought, there is no way that's going to happen to our bridge.
No, it couldn't have happened again. People were so scared of going back on a train at the time because of the Tay Bridge disaster, so they had to over-engineer and make a big spectacle of it.
Is that lobster pots there?
Yeah, they get a lot of lobster pots around all the rocks.
I didn't know that.
Forth Navigation, Sandy M. Sandy, Forth Nav. Yes, our central tower to the marine yard, over.
That's all copy, thanks, sir.
Yeah, Forth Nav, made of the Forth, Hawes Pier out to Inchcolm, thanks.
Made the Forth Hawes Pier for Inchcolm, so thanks.
So is that your traffic control, is it?
It is the equivalent, marine traffic control.
We're leaving the bridge well behind us now, but you still get the... It's just a fantastic image of the three bridges all together, and especially the one on the right, the North Tower that we built.
Yes, that was it. That was our tower. There's a lovely sort of geometric pattern going on there too, because you've got the cantilever bridge, the rail bridge in the foreground. Then you've got the verticals of the suspension bridge, the road bridge, and then behind it, this sort of lace wing effect of the third crossing.
But the day has softened. It's quite warm, it's misty. It's lovely.
A nice soft wind.
It's good. And we're approaching
Inchcombe.
Inchcombe.
Russell Moran's one of the stewards here for Historic Environment Scotland. Tell me something about this building in front of us here.
The Abbey building was built in 12th century, reputedly after Alexander I got shipwrecked on the island and a hermit looked after him for a while. It was built actually, although it was on the order of Alexander I, it was built mostly under the oversee of David I, his brother.
Because Alexander I had fallen off a cliff by that stage.
He had,
riding home to his young bride.
And it's been modified many times since, particularly in the 1400s.
So. We are distressing that bird and I don't know why. What is it?
Well, we might have some gulls or might have some chicks around about here, but most of them have left by this time.
Well, you would think so. That's what's kind of confusing. Yeah. I mean, you know, the mown lawn here is absolutely peppered with seabird feather.
Yes, we have blackback gulls and herring gulls mostly, but we also have puffins, we have oyster catchers, we have fulmars, quite a variety of them. But the blackback and the herring gulls are the vicious ones.
Yeah. How does the gig of being steward on this island work? I mean, do you go home at nights or is it a live aboard or what?
There is two stewards that live on the island. They live in the wee cottage at the back there. They stay 5 days a week and then they go off for 2 days. And then the relief stewards, like myself, come across and look after.
So is this a good gig?
I think it's a cracking gig. I also do places like Aberdare across the water and Dunfermline Abbey and Palace, but there's not many places you can say you came by boat to come out here.
Yeah. Well, we're saying just as we, because you literally walk about 100 metres round towards the wee beach there, and it's an entirely different environment. All of a sudden, you know, you start speaking more quietly. It has that sort of slightly Treasure Island feel about it.
It is.
Well, yeah. There's also this strange, there's this wartime behind us. What's going on there?
Well, at the moment, we use that for our shop and our small museum. I think it might have been an affy of some sort. I'm not sure, but it was. They are World War One and Two buildings. World War One and Two defences pepper the island.
As we were coming out on the boat, which is now leaving us, the skipper was telling me about this island over here.
Inchmickery.
And suggesting that the outline was built to look like a ship.
Yeah, that's the theory anyway.
What was the idea behind that?
So it would be another distraction for enemy ships or enemy subs coming in. They would see that and they would think they'd want to stay clear of it. But also there was listening posts all the way along. There had lines of
hydrophones
along through the Forth at that time. From the Hawks Creek point across in Aberdare. Yeah.
So do you like sharing it with people or do you quite like to have it
go
on
away.
Your own?
No, I very much like sharing it. The visitors are always curious about different aspects. There's always somebody that's interested about the Abbey, somebody that's interested about the World War One and Two stuff, or even the gnomes, One Inch Gnome.
Well, that's coming up.
Yes, let's talk about the gnomes.
Yeah, well, describe it first of all. You've got this...
It's nuts. You know, it's an outcropping of rock. First time we went past it in a little boat, outcropping of rock, and someone has basically nailed garden gnomes all over it, or glued garden gnomes. I don't know how you attach garden gnomes.
Are you responsible for that?
We are not responsible for it, no. And we do not encourage it.
I spoke to somebody years ago who said it's the wardens on the island that each bring a gnome and they leave it when they leave the island.
Well, I know it. The wardens that I've been on with have not done that.
These are responsible wardens?
We are responsible wardens.
Well, what's the theory then? How do you think it happened?
It happens while we are shut. We're shut over the winter and they breed over the winter.
The gnome gorillas come down in patrol boats.
So we have no idea who's doing it.
To a certain extent, this island is a microcosm of this entire area of the Forth in that you encapsulate over 1,000 years of history in a very, very small space.
Mm. Yes.
And probably much further back than that.
Yeah, we've got the Hogback Stone, which dates back more in terms of the Viking
period. What's a Hogback Burial Stone?
Hogback Burial Stone, yeah, we've got that in the museum.
I've seen those. I'm trying to think, it was in Luss. The civilist example in the churchyard in Luss. They look a bit like an upturned boat.
Yeah, so we have one in our small museum here. I mean, we've got the Abbey, we've got World War One and Two stuff, we've got the wildlife as well, we've got the seals and the bird life. So
what's your favourite bit?
My favourite bit is probably the chapter house.
Okay.
And
what was a chapter house?
The chapter house was the meeting place for the canons that lived here. And that is one of the few octagonal chapter houses. There's one at Holyrood and there's one up at...
I haven't been in this bit before.
Elgin Cathedral as well.
Yeah.
But this is quite spectacular.
So they would sit... this is absolutely spectacular. With a vaulted ceiling. And almost like a sort of triptych at the far end, where there would have been, I don't know, probably small statues or something.
Well, that would be the seats for the abbot and the sub-abbot and the high-ranking officials. And then the other canons would sit around here.
It's got a great echo, though.
Fantastic echo. It's just...
Hello!
Hello.
Why does you keep on saying echo?
Echo. It is a stunning, beautiful building.
It's stunning.
Lovely piece of carving, because the vaulted ceiling actually comes into a central rose, almost like knotwork.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And there would have been probably a candelabra or something coming down there.
Yeah.
To light up.
It's remarkably well preserved.
It is the most well preserved abbey in Scotland. So.
You still get a weekend monk here?
We do. Mark comes out from South Queensbury tours and he comes out and does a weekend tour over the July and August.
So just coming round the corner of the Abbey is the 21st century, basically. Finlandia Seaways.
It's a busy seaway. There's lots of...
It's a ferry, obviously. Roll on, roll off ferry. You just see the ramp and then... Well, you see the back of it now.
Yeah. It's not Ram's home. This has always been a busy seaway. Yeah,
exactly.
Presumably the island be an important part of that.
I would have thought so. I mean, as stewards, we've wondered about it and we've wondered whether it would be a good stopping off place from Iona going out down to Lindisfarne. There was close links because the canons here formed a priestly role as well. They weren't a exclusive monk trying to keep away from things. They served a lot of the parishes along the Fife coast and went across there. And there's very close ties to St. Fillan's across the water.
Come on, let's get the easy way up.
Easier. I didn't say it was easy.
No, I heard him say easy. I heard easy. There we go. We found a stairway inside the building itself. Russell is tripping up and we are trudging up. Okay.
This takes you halfway up the bell tower and then you...
Then it gets really stupid.
Then it gets really stupid, yes.
Yeah, that's it.
It's onwards and upwards if you want to go up to the top and get the views.
Yeah, well, yeah, all right, fine. Okay, it's this.
Oh, God, it's tiny.
Here we go. I'm just... This is so narrow and dark that I'm just making my way up. The steps are just big enough for my toes, essentially. And I've got my right arm jammed against the central pivot of the spiral staircase. Whew, dear me. That is tight. Oh! They had pigeons.
They had pigeons as well, yes.
We're in a ducat.
Halfway up the bell tower.
Deaf pigeons. Well, the view's getting better all the time.
Whew. And you've got another level of office.
Oh, for the love of goodness. It's quite unnecessarily tall, this bell tower.
That staircase is something else, isn't it?
It is the, without a doubt, it is the tightest spiral staircase I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, these monks must have been thin guys. Yeah.
Including the Vatican. Wow. That's good. Whew. Look at that.
Normally you get a good view of the three bridges now.
You've still got a good view of the three bridges. It's just out of focus, it's soft focus, it's misty. Yeah. It's really pretty. Ah, me.
So, bells hung from here, did they?
There would have been a level across here, I think, and they would have hung in there, yep, hung in that chamber bit there.
I said it before, I'll say it again. It feels completely different. Stone throw from Edinburgh. And it feels you could be, I don't know, somewhere in the Pacific, anywhere.
You are about, I would say, 2 linear miles away from the rail bridge. We're just looking at that Finlandia ferry we saw earlier, steaming up past. It doesn't look quite so incongruous as it does when it was going past the Abbey, and yet you could be forgiven for thinking, yeah, that over there, that's nowadays. Where we are, it's a different time period altogether.
It does. It does strike you as a different time period. And certainly when it's quiet like it is today.
This is quiet.
This is quiet. You just saw 100 people getting back onto that last boat. But that was the one boat. The rest of them have been fairly quiet today. But we do get a few people coming out saying, we're just looking for a piece of quiet. We're coming out here, get away from the crowds. It's a good place to come.
And it's kind of appropriate because we're leaving the peace and tranquility of the island and we're going back to the bridge.
If I kind of hunker down and look underneath the railings in the central reservation and underneath the wind baffles and past the fourth road bridge and past the fourth rail bridge, I can just about make the outline of where we were, Inchcombe Island, which means
that we are very smug people indeed, because we are on the new fourth crossing. We're actually on it.
Yeah.
It's not open to the public yet, but we are here. That's why we're smiling. But it's a really noisy environment. They've still got road sweepers, you've still got tractors, all kinds of things. You know, they're still tightening up nuts and bolts, but we're here.
And it's also an opportunity not just to experience the bridge in a way we'll probably never, ever be able to do again, because there'll just be a stream of traffic, you know, from the opening date. It's a chance to talk to some of the people who were instrumental in making this happen.
I'm Mike Glover. I'm the technical director for the Jacob Arup joint venture, and we are the delivery partners to Transport Scotland, the client.
I'm Michael Martin. I'm FCBC, that's the principal contractor's project director, so we're responsible for the design and the construction of the bridge.
We've spoken to both of you gentlemen before when this bridge was being built. You actually came back out of retirement for this.
I did, yes. Yes, I did.
Yeah. So was it worth it?
Of course it was worth it, yeah. It's been hard work, but I knew that it would be, but I did think it would be worth it. And the closer I get to the end, and once I've managed to shake the dust off and look back at the job, recover my sanity, I'll be enormously proud of it because it's a fantastic achievement.
So is that you going to retire now?
For the third time, three strikes and you're out, I'll be retiring.
Yep. This is quite a common theme, engineers retiring and they're not retiring.
Unfortunately, I have not retired yet. I'm 71 and heading towards 72, but I've worked continuously for the same firm, Arup, now for all that period of time.
I flew over here before these towers were actually built in a microlight, and I've got photographs of the caissons, and you can see, you know, the basically big steel rings. The fourth is sitting outside it, and you can see the seabed underneath. It's just fascinating.
Yeah. The biggest challenge, I think, which people probably don't appreciate, is the construction of the foundations. And those huge caissons you've described really were a major tour de force. I mean, they represent one of the first on this project, which was it's the largest concrete underwater pour ever made in the world.
When you say underwater, I mean, do you mean that the water was outside the caissons and we were actually pouring down into the water?
You pour the concrete, the caisson is filled with water, because otherwise the pressure outside would collapse it.
Okay.
So you balance the water inside and out, and then you put a large pipe down to the bottom, down to the rock, and you pump concrete into it, and that gradually displaces the water out of the centre of the caisson.
Does it not drive you nuts, though? all these people driving past, never even seeing it, never even appreciating the amount of work that's gone into that.
I think the response to that is that this is really why I'm speaking to you today, is because I'd like you to be able to get across to the public at large just where the major challenges are in creating bridges of this scale.
Yeah.
If this bridge was built on the land, it would be a much, much simpler exercise. When you think that every piece of concrete that went into the foundations, every piece of concrete that went into these huge towers had to be taken there on a barge, and all the people and all the shuttering every single day, when you think about that as a major effort, it's extraordinary.
When you look at a bridge, when it's finished, you see a bridge. But what you don't see is that the bridge is actually comprised of millions of different challenges. And yes, they need some sums to work out what you're doing, but they also need a means of procurement. You've got to buy the materials, you've got to plan the process, you've got to train the people to do the operations. There are literally millions of individual operations involved in building a bridge like this.
Do you find your sense of relief just building up all the time as you get closer to the opening?
One of my... there's going to be an enormous sense of relief from all my team when we get this open, because there's no doubt about it, it's a pretty stressful operation building up to the opening. When it comes to the end, it is ourselves, FCBC, the contractor. We're the ones who've got to deliver this job. And the closer you get to the end, the more pressure that comes on you. And my team here have been under immense pressure. This job is clearly very important for Scotland. Programme has always been very tight. And as you get towards the end, there is an end. And the amount of work that my team have to deliver in the last few months of a project is enormous.
It is easy to see engineers as, you know, in the old days, slide rule jockeys. You know, I mean, you know, there were number crunches, that kind of...
Well, yeah, I was quite good at the slide rule.
The thing is, I have never met an engineer who essentially didn't have the soul of a poet. It's not enough that the thing works. You want it to be beautiful as well, and you've really done it with this one.
That's very perceptive of you, really. To be a complete engineer, it's not just the mathematics and the physics. It is the visual form. It is the commodity and delight that matters, I think. But it doesn't come later. It's got to be at the very beginning of the project. And when you look at this bridge today, it brings together a number of major considerations that we had at the beginning of the process. And the first one is we wanted it to look beautiful. Second thing is we knew it had to be three towers, because being a rock in the middle. We knew it had to be a cable stay bridge, because that was the most economic way of building this for the spans. And the way we did that was to come up with a concept of what's called the crossing cables. The crossing cables then allow all of the towers to be very slender. And the crossing cables, really the trick that they bring to bear in the design, is they increase the stiffness of the structure. It's like a web. In structural terms, it increases the depth of the structure at the centre. So you think of the deck being the structure, but actually, because the cables are overlapping it, you've increased its depth quite considerably. And because of that, this structure is extremely stiff, and the centre tower is not floppy. It's very sturdy.
We've hit lucky today. It's a lovely day. There is a bit of cloud about, but it's not a disaster by any manner of means. There's probably about 5-10 miles of wind. That's it. How lucky or unlucky have you been with the weather during the construction process?
I think we've been very unlucky, to be
honest.
Very unlucky, yeah. I've lived in Scotland now for 40 years, and I've seen quite a big change in the winters. When I came to Scotland, you would get proper winters, they'd be cold, but what that generally means is you'd have high pressure, and so it would generally be calm. We get mild winters now, but that generally means it's windy and it's wet. And those two conditions, particularly wind, but more recently when we've been waterproofing wet, they stop us working. Now, we can be lucky with that, because there are certain operations where it's not that important that the wind's blowing, and so you don't mind having some wind so long as it arrives at the right time. You don't mind it raining so long as it arrives at the right time. From my perspective, we've been very unlucky with that, and constantly been battling against the weather.
Putting up these cables, for example, or even the tower cranes, that must have been an absolute nightmare.
Well, to give you an idea about the effect the wind can have, when we took down the first tower crane, It takes about 12 days to take down a tower crane with what we call self-climbing. They climb themselves up, they climb themselves down. But you need certain weather conditions to do it. And if you get those weather conditions, 12 to 15 days at the most, you'll get the crane down. We started taking the first tower crane down not long into this year. It took us 63 days
63.
To just get the jib of the crane down to deck level. Yeah. And that's because the wind conditions were awful. There was day after day we just couldn't work. Yeah. And it, not only does it stop that operation, but it stops other operations around it and follow-on operations.
One question you started, it's all very well being an engineer, being a poet. How much do you have to be a politician as well?
The modern engineer has to be almost Renaissance man, in the sense that not only has he got to be a good mathematician and very good at physics, but he also has to understand the art of diplomacy and the fact that actually you achieve things through teams. Yeah. And so having an attitude towards collaboration is important. And I guess that then feeds into embracing political will and trying to find a way of achieving the community's objectives as well as your own physical objectives of design. One of the other important decisions we made at the very beginning of the project is that we did not want the bumpity-bump that you get 100 times crossing the Forth Bridge. We wanted a continuous structure which didn't have any joints. That's quite an undertaking when you consider the bridge is 2.7 kilometres long. Yeah. But on this bridge, we have one expansion joint at one end and one expansion joint at the other, and the bridge is continuous from one end to the other, which means that the deck slides past the intermediate, the flanking towers, and is only fixed in the centre. So a simple diagram is the centre tower is fixed, and the deck then has no...
It's in and out either side.
Either side, which
These
is magic.
These things too, I mean, basically you've got wind baffles on either side of this.
Yes,
which
this
should mean you shouldn't have to shut the bridge.
Well, the line that we would always take on this is if you can reach the bridge, you will cross it, because this is a much more benign environment than you will encounter on either side of the bridge. But this has got a much higher endurance than the FRB. Yeah.
How did you manage to bring it in under budget?
Yeah.
This won't take long. When we started on the project 10 years ago, the budget was put at £4 billion. Uh-huh. The unfortunate thing was that at the same time, the financial markets in the world 2007 had collapsed. So therefore, the money couldn't be raised internationally. And we were confronted with a situation where really the only real model that would work is a one where the Scottish government could pay for it by itself from its own monies. So that was a figure which was much, much less. So we then agreed with the client, and I think this is a very brave decision on the part of the client, that we would challenge every single item which was on the this is the project. And one of those items was the Forth Road Bridge, which was designated as not being operational. And we, with a lot of effort actually, managed to demonstrate that the existing bridge, although in a deteriorated state, was capable of carrying public transport, taxis, etc. That meant that this bridge, the new bridge, would not have to cater for them as well. Yeah. That meant we could reduce the bridge by 20 metres in width, which meant that it was a much, much more economical approach. The second thing we did is we introduced technology. You see the gantry here, for example. It will have not just warning signs, but it's monitoring the traffic. It's controlling the traffic flows. So that means that we didn't end up with three lanes of traffic. We could do with two. And then the third thing we did is we looked at the existing road network and asked ourselves how we could use the existing roads, albeit enhanced, to actually avoid having to build new motorways. If you combine those factors, and there are some other little nuances, not least of which is the crossing cables, because the crossing cables not only enable that centre tower to be slender and end up with this elegant design, it also is very economic in materials. So the actual tonnage of the bridge and the materials that go with it reduced.
How do you feel being here today on a finished bridge?
It's difficult to explain because it's an emotional response. Overwhelmed.
that, you know, after 10 years it's here. But actually, at the back of my mind all the time is, and this does sound a bit cheesy, but it's sincere. That is, it's a gift. You know, my skills, my team, the whole team have really given a gift to the community, because that, as a civil engineer, is the biggest thing you can do, is to give to the community something which will change their lives. And it's interesting, the project I did before this was the Channel Tunnel Rail Link, for example, HS1 as people call it, as a technical director for that. And you could see, in retrospect, going back to the communities that you had put the train through and whatever, huge change. I mean, enormous. And I think that's what the greatest feeling I get is obviously relief, overwhelmed with the skill of it, but actually the joy of what it's going to mean for people into the future.
Sean Galt is an apprentice on the bridge. How long have you worked here?
2 years, that's it.
And you're nearly finished?
Aye, almost.
What is it you're actually doing today?
Just tightening up the nuts and bolts and then putting grip on them.
I have to say, standing to my left here is Mr. Ewan McElraith with a spanner. So if the bridge collapses at this point, it's his fault.
Well, it's kind of sense of tidying it up. We were here
building the bridge, aren't we?
2 years ago.
Yeah, 2015.
Put up some scaffolding. So we worked on this bridge.
When we say we put up some scaffolding, we handed somebody a clamp. I'm not sure if that counts.
Still counts, but it'd be really quite nice just to finish it off.
You've got the thing on a lanyard.
Okay, how tight does it need to go?
As tight as you can get it.
I'll tell you what's wrong, it's spinning on the inside.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
I imagine you want a piece of this as well.
Go on then, swap.
That's it.
There you go.
Right.
It's spinning on me too.
Childish, I know, but what a way to finish a programme.
Absolutely brilliant way to actually finish off our programme down the second side of the fourth. From all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thank you very much for listening, and join us next week if you can. Cheers.